One of the benefits of living in a different culture for a significant period of time is that you start taking on aspects of their view of the world. So what my family found after living in Ethiopia for a few years, that after some time, we were less uptight about time. We'd started taking on the African view of time. And of course, most of you would be aware, in theory anyway, African time is different. They don't measure time like we do. Our culture can be dominated by the question, what time is it? Meaning, what should I be doing now according to what that round thing on the wall tells me? We measure time even to the thousandth of a second for various purposes. In Australia, we get uptight if a train is 5 minutes late. I'm told in Japan, if it's 1 minute late, people are nearly suicidal. In rural Ethiopia, after 5 hours, people will just be sitting around thinking, what a great opportunity to relate. I'm not suggesting either is right or wrong, but we need to take care as we read a passage like this, dominated by the word time, that we don't impose our culture's view of time onto this book. One of our colleagues in Ethiopia wanted to take a particularly gifted rural student to an ag conference in a neighbouring country, but he didn't have a passport. In fact, he didn't have a birth certificate. So we went to this small town to help him fabricate a birth certificate. But the problem is, the people in that town don't think in terms of dates and time. They think in terms of events and relationships. So they had to try and work out when he was born based on what people remember was going on around the time of his birth, and then translate that into some sort of date to satisfy the authorities in the capital city. So they basically had to fabricate a birth certificate, which was to the people of this place a pointless thing anyway. What do you need that for? It's obvious that you're here. So the book of Ecclesiastes, when it uses the word time, it's not interested in dates and measurements of time. It's interested in events and relationships and how that creates different seasons in life and how people react to those different circumstances or seasons. Because to live wisely in this world, we must be able to discern the season of life that we're in. Now, just before we engage the text specifically, we need to just briefly remind ourselves of some preliminaries before we engage these concepts. Firstly, Ecclesiastes is wisdom literature. Wisdom literature is common to all cultures in various degrees. You would have heard your grandmothers, no doubt, quoting various proverbs. The uniqueness of biblical wisdom literature is that it is wisdom filtered through the people of God. And the main premise is that God as creator knows the correct and best way to live in the world that he made. That makes sense, doesn't it? So true wisdom derives from the fact that God made the world to function in a certain way, and to be wise is to listen to what he says about the best way to live in this world. Superficially, though, Ecclesiastes seems to defy this category of wisdom, doesn't it? But it doesn't. Because we cannot live wisely in a world we don't understand. See, if we don't understand the true nature of the world, how can we live in it wisely? Even as Christians, sometimes we have very naive views of the world. We live in a make-believe world that we've constructed in our mind that's not, doesn't align very well with the real world as it is. We haven't thought hard enough about the true nature of reality and what it means to live life under the sun. And rightly, many people have noted that Ecclesiastes is connected reasonably strongly to Genesis chapter 3. God's good world has been grossly distorted by the rebellion of his image bearers. This is the world we now live in. Someone once said, to be disillusioned, you must first have had illusions. Ecclesiastes strips away those illusions and presents us with some hard but truthful insights into living life under the sun. I don't know if you've realised this, but Cinderella is not a documentary. Hollywood does not present life as it really is. Ecclesiastes does. If we want to be wise, we must come to grips with the nature of the world as it really is. And as Chris has outlined, this is seen in the prominent words used by Ecclesiastes, such as temporary or vanity or emptiness. But this word has a much more confronting sense than just temporary. It takes on the meaning futile or pointless. See, the temporary nature of our life devalues all our toil and effort, because the net result at the end is being lowered into the ground in a box. The new house you build tomorrow will be pushed over in 50 years and considered rubbish. In 100 years from now, you will be effectively forgotten and be just a name on one of your descendants' social studies projects. All you ever did will be considered negligible. I had an uncle in New Zealand who manned a telecommunications station in the Great Alps. He endured incredible hardships in winter to make sure communications could go across the South Island of New Zealand. In the age of satellites, that role is now completely redundant. It's now considered an utterly pointless job. The mistake Ecclesiastes wants us to avoid making is to think that is not us. Another key idea is life under the sun. And this is important because it provides the perspective or view from which Ecclesiastes is assessing life. Life under the sun speaks of limits to our understanding. We can't see very far in terms of any big plan or purpose for this world, for our particular life. What meaning does it have? We can't see the complete picture. We just observe what happens in an extremely short space of time, in a small area of a very small planet, in a small solar system of a massive universe. Do we want to be wise? If so, we must come to grips with the world as it really is, so we can assess the validity of the answers, which most people have some sort of opinion about. But if we don't get a proper perspective, any answers won't amount to much. And the particular concern of this passage in Ecclesiastes is the idea of time. And the word time in this context has a sense of a season or duration of time dominated by a certain experience. See, it's not talking about time in an abstract sense, but in the sense that stuff happens, like a series of events and relationships. But as we read the first verse, the mistake we could make is to think it's talking about how we plan our life, how we fill our diaries and use the time that we have. But that's not what Ecclesiastes is doing here. What Ecclesiastes wants to emphasize is that we, in fact, have very little control over the circumstances and seasons of our life. There's a subtle change of terminology here that alerts us to this fact. The teacher doesn't use the expression life under the sun, but every matter under heaven. Heaven is the dwelling of God who governs all things. And the first pair of experiences that come upon us make this abundantly clear. A time to be born and a time to die. You don't write those in your diary. You don't plan those or determine those. Whatever else we do in our life occurs within those boundaries or time markers. We don't have any say over our birth. And we have very little say over the time and circumstances of our death. In preparation for this talk, I did a bit of personal reminiscing just to get into the spirit of it. And one incident that came to mind was when I was in my final year at uni. I was working in a servo and I was just about ready to close before midnight. And a guy with a trench coat and a balaclava came in, pointed a pump action 22 at my head and said, "Give me the money." A number of things go through your head at a moment like that. One of which was, sure, it's not mine. My boss has insurance. But had I been a wiser person, and at the time, as I was reflecting on what happened to me and that reasonably significant potential brush with death, I might have gained a lot more wisdom in the manner of Ecclesiastes instead of my primary thought, which was, this will impress the boys. And it did. See, our culture tends to ignore death. But to be wise, we must face up to its certainty. It's not something you will avoid. As certain as we are born, we'll die. These are the ultimate seasons of our life. Now, these opposing pairs of experiences that Ecclesiastes 1 to 8 goes on to talk about probably shouldn't surprise us if we're wise people, because life is made up of these types of things. That's not to say it won't be painful or joyful, but if we've learned wisdom, it won't be surprising. Just as human life has a beginning and an end, so does the life of a plant. Still verse 2. Plants are sown, they're ripped out again. Again, Ecclesiastes is comparing various forms of natural cycles with human life. This is deliberate because it wants to keep us aware of our limitations and our creatureliness. We're not self-determining people. We're not self-existing. We are dependent for our life. Of course, at another level, human beings are separate from the animals and plants. A zebra, while being chased by a lion, probably isn't thinking, "Why is this happening to me?" There can't be a God because there's no justice in the world. See, as human beings, we do ask these questions. We do ponder the seasons of our life. Verse 3, there are times for destroying and killing, for building up and healing. Again, these are things that happen that are not necessarily planned by us. Not many people I know want to live in a time of war and destruction. And the danger for Australians at the moment is to not recognise the true nature of the world, because my generation anyway has not been personally involved in a serious conflict that threatens the livelihood of Australia. We could wrongly start to be overly optimistic about the human condition because we don't reflect enough on our history and watch the news carefully enough to see that there are numerous active wars going on right now. Unfortunately, conflict is not an anomaly of living life under the sun. Ecclesiastes is not endorsing war and destruction, but reminding us of its tragic certainty. There's human beings, there's descendants of Adam, there'll be conflict. Verse 4 is similar, but more personal and immediate. Again, no one writes in their diary, next Wednesday, a time to mourn. Times of mourning will happen, just as times of great joy will happen. Usually, we don't plan them. They happen to us. But if we're wise, we'll recognize the seasons of times of life for what they are and respond to them appropriately. Things will happen to us where the right and proper response is to grieve. And it continues to engage with various other human experiences under the sun, verses 5 to 8. There are times appropriate to making stuff, growing crops. There are appropriate times to throw things away. There are times to embrace in relationships, times when relationships will be difficult. We will experience times of hatred and tension, either at the personal level of family and friends or in a broader context of racial tension or alcohol-fueled violence. This is life under the sun. So what's the point of all these descriptions of these contrasting experiences, events or emotions that will dominate our life under the sun? Again, one of the main ideas is that we cannot escape this. None of us are above it all. Stuff happens. The concern of Ecclesiastes is, how do we engage all this in a wise way? I don't know if you've thought about this, but there's actually an art to living. And part of this is recognizing the seasons of life for what they are and being able to adapt to different seasons of life. I'm sure in various ways we've all been trapped in the mentality of wishing things were different. I wish I was married. I wish I had a better job. I wish my friends didn't move away. Alternatively, endless reminiscing about the good old days is a failure to recognize that life under the sun doesn't work that way. For those of you familiar with Bruce Springsteen, his song Glory Days is a great reflection on this. It's a song about a few people who can only look back at a time when their life seemed to mean something more. But there's no use thinking that way, because that's not the real world. That's not the world we actually live in. And if we try to live as though the world is other than it really is, it won't work. It'll all end in tears, or much worse. See, it takes a certain amount of wisdom to recognize the different seasons of life and respond appropriately. And in our culture, we have a particularly nasty expression of this failure. There are not many worse things in life than to witness a 40 to 50-year-old man behaving like they're 20 again. We even have a name for it. It's called a midlife crisis. And it's brought about as they realize that most of their productive life is over and they feel like they haven't utilized it fully, so they better get going. It's an issue of time, of wasted time, of not coming to grips with the seasons of life. They trade in their old wife for a young trophy wife, buy a sports car, and go nuts for a few years. This is a pathetic or foolish example of not recognizing the seasons of life and responding appropriately. If you're over 40, you cannot ever, under the sun, go back to being 20 again. The time is over. Get over it. Adapt to middle age. And the rest of this passage develops this idea in terms of the contrast between these fluctuating seasons of life and yet desiring eternity, desiring to live forever. And verse 9 does this by repeating an important idea in Ecclesiastes. What point is there in all this? What profit is there in all this toil? When we look at these contrasting pairs of experiences in verses 2 to 8, they sort of cancel each other out, don't they? We laugh, we grieve. We experience hatred and love. We gain possessions, we lose them. What's the net outcome? Zero. Futility. Pointlessness. There appears to be no net gain in all these experiences. Nothing is achieved under the sun. It's chasing the wind. And verses 10 to 11 are really important in the overall framework of this book because we can see more of the source of this sense of futility and frustration. On one hand, God appoints the seasons of our life and gives us things to occupy our time. Yet on the other hand, we desire eternity because God has put it into our hearts to embrace life forever. So we live with this incredible tension in life under the sun. We want forever, but we live, we're trapped in this seasons of, in this these periods of time or seasons of life that we can't escape from. And we shouldn't underestimate the importance of this tension. We shouldn't ignore it. Also, verse 11, there's a significant idea that God has made everything beautiful in its time. This heightens the tension. There is a beauty about every season of life, if we have the wisdom to see it. Yet we cannot hang on to it because it's only beautiful for that particular time. It can't last in life under the sun. It's not meant to. Sunsets don't exist at lunchtime. Our culture even has sayings to this effect. I wish this moment could last forever. But it can't. That's not life under the sun. That's not the real world as we experience it. For most of us, I'm sure we've had experiences where we've sought happiness and found it elusive. Yet times of happiness come upon us in surprising and unexpected ways. Again, we're not in control of the seasons of our life. Stuff happens. We cannot manufacture experiences and emotions at will. All we can do is live and respond well to the various seasons of life as they happen. And this is wisdom, to be able to do that. Why has God ordained things this way? Again, the answer is blunt but honest, so that man cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to end. We are deliberately kept from knowing more than we do, so that we do feel this tension between living now and desiring eternity. And verses 12 to 13 help us unpack this a bit more. It's a valid thing to enjoy life, though we have limited control over it. Enjoy your work and those you work with. Enjoy the daily pleasures of life, such as eating and drinking. See, the choices of Ecclesiastes are we can live a happy life chasing the wind or a miserable life chasing the wind. See, you might as well do it happily if you can. I was an unusual teenager in that I used to read Ecclesiastes frequently, and I found it hard to be happy sometimes because these questions burden me so much. But the message of Ecclesiastes is, if you can, chase the wind happily. enjoy it. So when you sit down to a medium rare Scotch fillet with pepper sauce, don't just think, oh, well, I better eat this because my body needs protein. Enjoy it. It's a gift of God to enjoy it. On the other hand, as you would have seen last week, don't make the enjoyment of food and possessions and career an end in themselves, because it's utterly meaningless. Don't be like MasterChef, where satisfying the stomach is worshipped, because it will all end badly. See, Christians are not ascetics. We don't believe enjoyment is bad. We believe enjoying food and relationships and possessions is the gift of God. It's much better to enjoy life chasing the wind than being miserable. But verses 14 to 15 are the real kicker. However hard we try, we will never have any real control over the seasons of our life, because only God does. And he does it so that people will fear him and respond to him appropriately. Only what God does lasts forever. Only God's ultimate plan will endure. And we are not God. The wisdom of Ecclesiastes is that we must come to grips with the reality that we are small cogs in a big machine. We are not necessary to God or the world. Don't misunderstand, I didn't say we are not loved by God deeply, but we're not essential. And in seeing how dependent we are, and in how little control we have over this life, it ought to drive us to God for, among other things, wisdom. God says in Psalm 81, "Open your mouth wide, and I will fill it." Because verse 15, no matter how much we try to rise above all this, we're no different to those before us. We're not unique. There's nothing new. It's all been done before. We'll not come up with answers that our ancestors didn't. Having iPads hasn't resolved any of the questions that Ecclesiastes poses. It's just given us more time to do what? Chase the wind. Of course, an alternative response to not knowing very much and not having control over the seasons of our life is not to fear God and seek him, but to hate him. And this is the perspective of atheism, isn't it? It's not so much that they don't believe in God, it's that they hate him. Atheists are confident enough in their own wisdom, enough to say that all the confusion and inability to control life and explain it is simply because there is no good and wise God who stands behind it. Another alternative response is that of most Australians, at least on the surface, which is, let's try to just ignore all these nagging questions. Let's just put them on the shelf in the too hard basket and let's not engage them at all. But another function of Ecclesiastes is to remind us it's okay to ask these questions. It's okay to think deeply, to feel the weight of these tensions of living life under the sun. In fact, we're foolish if we don't. Because even though in Ecclesiastes the wise and foolish alike die, it's still much better to be wise. We need to engage because instinctively we know that there is more. There is eternity, even though we'll never be able to step back far enough to see it in our life under the sun. So just in terms of some concluding reflections, what we must not do, which ironically some people do, is dumb down or soften the message of Ecclesiastes. because it's too confronting and real. This is life under the sun. If we're going to be wise people, we must engage with this. Ecclesiastes presents us with a real and true and wise appraisal of what it means for Adam's descendants to live under the sun. We have limited control over the seasons of our life, and ultimate answers are kept from us deliberately so that we can recognize our dependence and limitations and fear God, on whom all that we are and do depends. Another mistake is to think that since Jesus has come, all the questions posed in Ecclesiastes are solved and answered in our experience of life. Again, this is not true, because Ecclesiastes isn't posing theoretical questions. It's describing what our life is like if we're prepared to face up to it, and that hasn't changed. What the coming of Jesus has done is given us a fuller and richer expression of how God will resolve this tension for us of desiring eternity and yet being ruled by times and seasons of life. We still experience despair, joy, confusion, happiness. Yet in Jesus, time and eternity meet. The eternal God himself enters life under the sun. He dies a death which we deserve and is raised to a glorious new and eternal life. And that life is available to all those with the wisdom to seek him. Knowing Jesus won't change that life has various seasons, but it means that we know the eternal one who lived life under the sun. He grieved deeply. He expressed thankfulness and delight in God the Father. He lived at a time of intense hatred and war. He rejoiced in God's purposes. He wept at human wickedness. We can know this one, in whom time and eternity meet. At the right time, God sent Jesus, born of a woman, to undo what humanity have done. This generates a certain greater urgency to engage the tension of living life under the sun and desiring eternity. These are not questions we should ignore and put on the shelf. We need to be more urgent in engaging the questions of Ecclesiastes and not ignoring them.